Follow us? I asked. She shrugged. There are a lot of us, and you killed some of them. I think they'll take their revenge on other weaker travelers. Another shrug. To them, we're all the same. A traveler is a traveler. So, unless we get caught in one of their fires, we'll be okay, yeah. They hate everybody who isn't them. They would have sold my Tory to get some more roe. I looked at her bruised, swollen face. Bankole had given her something for her pain. I was grateful for that, and half angry at him for refusing to give me anything. He didn't understand my numbness and grogginess back at the cops, and it disturbed him. Well, at least that had faded away. Let him die 3 or 4 times and see how he feels. No, I'm glad he'll never know how it feels. It makes no sense. That brief, endless agony over and over, it makes no sense at all. I keep catching myself wondering how it is that I'm still alive. Emery, I said, keeping my voice low. She looked at me. You know I'm a sharer. She nodded, then glanced sidelong at Bankole. He knows, I assured her. But, look, you and Grayson are the first sharers I've known who had children. There was no reason to tell her she and Grayson and their children were the first sharers I'd known, period. I hope to have kids myself someday, so I need to know. Do they always inherit the sharing? One of my boys didn't have it, she said. Some feelers, sharers, can't have any kids. I don't know why. And I knew some who had 2 or 3 kids who didn't have it at all. Bosses, though, they like you to have it. I'll bet they do. Sometimes, she continued, sometimes they pay more. For people who have it, especially kids. Her kids. Yet they had taken a boy who wasn't a sharer and left a girl who was. How long would it have been before they came back for the girl? Perhaps they had a lucrative offer for the boys as a pair, so they sold them first. My God, Bankole said, this country has slipped back 200 years. Things were better when I was little, Emery said. My mother always said they would get better again. Good times would come back. She said they always did. My father would shake his head and not say anything. She looked around to see where Tori was and spotted her on Grayson Mora's shoulders. Then she caught sight of something else and she gasped. We followed her gaze and saw fire creeping over the hills behind us, far behind us, but not far enough. This was some new fire, whipping along in the dry evening breeze. Either the people who attacked us had followed us, setting fires, or someone was imitating them, echoing them. We went on, moving faster, trying to see where we could go to be safe. On either side of the highway, there was dry grass. There were trees, living and dead. So far, the fire was only on the north side. We kept to the south side, hoping it would be safe. There was a lake ahead, according to my map of the area. Clear Lake, it was called. The map showed it to be large, and the highway followed its northern shore for a few miles. We would reach it soon. How soon? I calculated as we walked. Tomorrow. We should be able to camp near it tomorrow evening. Not soon enough. I could smell the smoke now. Did that mean the wind was blowing the fire toward us? Other people began hurrying and keeping to the south side of the road and heading west. No one went east now. There were no trucks yet, but it was getting late. They would be barreling through soon, and we should be camping for the night soon. Did we dare? The south side still seemed free of fire behind us, but on the north side, The fire crawled after us, coming no closer, but refusing to be left behind. We went on for a while, all of us looking back often, all of us tired, some of us hurting. I called a halt and gestured us off the road to the south at a place where there was room to sit and rest. "We can't stay here," Mora said. "The fire could jump the road any time." "We can rest here for a few moments," I said. "We can see the fire, and it will tell us when we'd better start walking again."
"We'd better start now," Mara said. "If that fire gets going good, it will move faster than we can run. Best to keep well ahead of it."
"Best to have the strength to keep ahead of it," I said. And I took a water bottle from my pack and drank. We were within sight of the road, and we had made it a rule not to eat or drink in such exposed places, but today that rule had to be suspended. To go into the hills away from the road might mean being cut off from the road by fire. We couldn't know when or where a wind-blown piece of burning debris might land. Others followed my example, and drank and ate a little dried fruit, meat, and bread. Bankole and I shared with Emery and Tori. Mora seemed to want to leave in spite of us, but his daughter Doe was sitting half asleep on the ground against Zara. He stooped next to her and made her drink a little water and eat some fruit.
"We might have to keep moving all night," Allie said, her voice almost too soft to hear. "This might be the only rest we get." And to Travis, "You'd better put Dominique into the carriage with Justin when he's finished eating."
Travis nodded. He'd carried Dominique this far. Now he tucked him in with Justin. "I'll push the carriage for a while," he said. Bankole looked at my wound, rebandaged it, and this time gave me something for the pain. He buried the bloody bandages he had removed, digging a shallow hole with a flat rock. Emery, with Tori gone to sleep against her, looked to see what Bankole was doing with me, then jumped and looked away, her hand going to her own side.
"I didn't know you were hurt so much," she whispered.
"I'm not," I said, and made myself smile. "It looks nastier than it is with all the blood, but it isn't bad. I'm damn lucky compared to Jill. And it doesn't stop me from walking."
"You didn't give me any pain when we were walking," she said.
I nodded, glad to know I could fake her out.
"It's ugly," I said, "but not too painful."
She settled down as though she felt better. No doubt she did. If I moaned and groaned, I'd have all four of them moaning and groaning. The kids might even bleed along with me. I would have to be careful and keep lying at least as long as the fire was a threat, or as long as I could. The truth was, those blood-saturated bandages scared the hell out of me, and the wound hurt worse than ever. But I knew I had to keep going or burn. After a few minutes, Bankole's pills began to take the edge off my pain, and that made the whole world easier to endure. We'd had about an hour's rest before the fire made us too nervous to stay where we were. Then we got up and walked. By then, at some point behind us, the fire had already jumped the road. Now, neither the north nor the south side looked safe. Until it was dark, all we could see in the hills behind us was smoke. It was a terrifying, looming, moving wall. Later, after dark, we could see the fire eating its way toward us. There were dogs running along the road with us, but they paid no attention to us. Cats and deer ran past us, and a skunk scuttled by. It was live and let live. Neither humans nor animals were foolish enough to waste time attacking one another. Behind us, and to the north, the fire began to roar. We put Tori in the carriage, and Justin and Dominique between her legs. The babies never even woke up when we were moving them. Tori herself was more than half asleep,
I worried that the carriage might break down with the extra weight, but it held. Travis, Harry, and Allie traded off pushing it. Dough, we put atop the load on Bancole's cart. She couldn't have been comfortable there, but she didn't complain. She was more awake than Tori. And she had been walking on her own most of the time since our encounter with the would-be kidnappers. She was a strong little kid. Her father's daughter. Grace and Mora helped push Bancole's cart. In fact, once Doe was loaded aboard, Mora pushed the cart most of the time. The man wasn't likable, but in his love for his daughter he was admirable. At some point in the endless night, more smoke and ash than ever began to swirl around us, and I caught myself thinking that we might not make it. Without stopping, we wet shirts, scarves, whatever we had, and tied them around our noses and mouths. The fire roared and thundered its way past us on the north, singeing our hair and clothing, making breathing a terrible effort. The babies woke up and screamed in fear and pain, then choked and almost brought me down. Tori, crying herself with their pain and her own, held on to them and would not let them struggle out of the carriage. I thought we would die. I believed there was no way for us to survive this sea of fire, hot wind, smoke, and ash. I saw people, strangers, fall, and we left them, lying on the highway, waiting to burn. I stopped looking back. In the roar of the fire, I couldn't hear whether they screamed. I could see the babies before Natividad threw wet rags over them. I knew they were screaming. Then I couldn't see them, and it was a blessing. We began to run out of water. There was nothing to do except keep going or burn. The terrible, deafening noise of the fire increased, then lessened, and again increased, then lessened. It seemed that the fire went north, away from the road, then whipped back down toward us. It teased, like a living, malevolent thing, intent on causing pain and terror. It drove us before it like dogs chasing a rabbit. Yet it didn't eat us. It could have, but it didn't. In the end, the worst of it roared off to the northwest. Firestorm, Bancole called it later. Yes, like a tornado of fire, roaring around, just missing us, playing with us, then letting us live. We could not rest. There was still fire. Little fires that could grow into big ones. Smoke, blinding and choking smoke. No rest. But we could slow down. We could emerge from the worst of the smoke and ash and escape the lash of the hot winds. We could pause by the side of the road for a moment and gag in peace. There was a lot of gagging. Coughing and gagging, and crying muddy tracks onto our faces. It was incredible. We were going to survive. We were still alive and together, scorched and miserable, in great need of water, but alive. We were going to make it. Later, when we dared, we went off the road, unloaded my pack from Bancole's cart, and dug out his extra water bottle. He dug it out. He'd told us he had it when he could have kept it for himself. We'll reach Clear Lake sometime tomorrow, I said. Early tomorrow, I think. I don't know how far we've come or where we are now, so I can only guess that we'll get there early. But it is there, waiting for us tomorrow. People grunted or coughed and downed swallows from Bancole's extra bottle. The kids had to be prevented from guzzling too much water. As it was, Dominique choked and began to cry again. We camped where we were, within sight of the road. Two of us had to stay awake on watch. I volunteered for first watch because I was in too much pain to sleep. I got my gun back from Natividad, checked to see that she had reloaded it. She had.
and looked around for a partner.
I'll watch with you, Grayson Mora said.
That surprised me. I would have preferred someone who knew how to use a gun, someone I would trust with a gun.
I'm not going to be able to sleep until you do, he said. It's that simple. So let's both put our pain to good use.
I looked at Emery and the two girls to see whether they'd heard, but they seemed to be already asleep. All right, I said. We've got to watch for strangers and fire. Give me a yell if you see anything unusual.
Give me a gun, he said. If anybody comes close, I can at least use it to scare them.
In the dark, sure. No gun, I said. Not yet. You don't know enough yet. He stared at me for several seconds, then went over to Bancole. He turned his back to me as he talked to Bancole.
Look, you know I need a gun to do any guarding in a place like this. She doesn't know how it is. She thinks she does, but she doesn't.
Bancole shrugged. If you can't do it, man, go to sleep. One of us will take the watch with her.
Shit. Mora made the word long and nasty. Shit. First time I saw her, I knew she was a man. Just didn't know she was the only man here.
Absolute silence.
Though Mora saved the situation to the degree that it could be saved, at that moment, she stepped up behind her father and tapped him on the back. He spun around more than ready to fight, spun with such speed and fury that the little girl squealed and jumped back.
What the hell are you doing up? He shouted. What do you want?
Frightened, the little girl just stared at him. After a moment, she extended her hand, offering a pomegranate.
Zara said we could have this, she whispered. Would you cut it?
Good thinking, Zara. I didn't turn to look at her, but I was aware of her watching. By now, everyone still awake was watching.
Everyone's tired and everyone's hurting, I told him. Everyone. Not just you. But we've managed to keep ourselves alive by working together and by not doing or saying stupid things.
And if that's not good enough for you, Bancole added in a voice low and ugly with anger, tomorrow you can go out and find yourself a different kind of group to travel with. A group too goddamn macho to waste its time saving your child's life twice in one day.
There must be something worthwhile in Mora. He didn't say anything. He took out his knife and cut the pomegranate into quarters for dough. Then kept half of it because she insisted that he was supposed to have half. They sat together and ate the juicy, seedy red fruit. Then Mora tucked dough in again and found himself a perch where, gunless, he began his first watch. He said nothing more about guns, and he never apologized. Of course, he didn't leave us. Where would he go? He was a runaway slave. We were the best thing he'd found so far. The best he was going to find as long as he had dough with him. We didn't reach Clear Lake the next morning. To tell the truth, it was already the next morning when we went to sleep. We were too tired and sore to get up at dawn, which came early in the second watch. Only the need for water made us move out when we did. At a hot, smoky 11 a.m. We found the corpse of a young woman when we got back to the road. There wasn't a mark on her, but she was dead.
I want her clothes, Emery whispered. She was near to me, or I wouldn't have heard her.
The dead woman was about her size, and dressed in a cotton shirt and pants that looked almost new. They were dirty, but far less so than Emery's clothes.
Strip her, then, I said. I'd help you, but I'm not bending too well this morning.
I'll give her a hand, Allie whispered.
Justin was asleep in his carriage with Dominique, so she was free to help with the ordinary, unspeakable things that we did now to live. The dead woman had not even soiled herself in her dying. That made the job less disgusting than it could have been. Rigor mortis had set in, however, and stripping her was a job for two. There was no one but us on this stretch of road, so Emery and Allie had all the time they needed. We had seen no other walkers yet this morning. Emery and Allie took every scrap of clothing, including underwear, socks, and boots, even though Emery thought the boots would be too big for her. No matter. If no one could wear them, she could sell them. In fact, it was the boots that yielded Emery the first cash she had ever owned. On the farm where she had been a slave, she had been paid only in company scrip. Worthless except on the farm, and almost worthless there. Stitched into the tongue of each of the dead woman's boots were 5 folded $100 bills. $1,000 in all. We had to tell her how little that was. If she were careful, and shopped only at the cheapest stores and ate no meat, wheat, or dairy products, it might feed her for 2 weeks. It might feed both her and Tori for a week and a half. Still, it seemed riches to Emery. Late that day, when we reached Clear Lake, much smaller than I had expected, we came across a tiny expensive store, being run from the back of an old truck near a cluster of half-burned, collapsed cabins. It sold fruit, vegetables, nuts, and smoked fish. We all had to buy a few things, but Emery squandered too much money on pears and walnuts for everyone. She delighted in passing these around and being able to give us something for a change. She's all right. We'll have to teach her about shopping and the value of money, but she's worth something, Emery is. And she's decided she's one of us. Sunday, September 26th, 2027. Somehow, we've reached our new home, Bankole's land in the coastal hills of Humboldt County. The highway, US 101, is to the east and north of us, and Cape Mendocino and the sea are to the west. A few miles south are state parks, filled with huge redwood trees and hordes of squatters. The land surrounding us, however, is as empty and wild as any I've seen. It's covered with dry brush, trees, and tree stumps, all far removed from any city, and a long, hilly walk from the little towns that line the highway. There's farming around here, and logging, and just plain isolated living. According to Bankole, it's best to mind your own business, and not pay too much attention to how people on neighboring plots of land earn a living. If they hijack trucks on 101, grow marijuana, distill whiskey, or brew up some more complicated illegal substances, well, live and let live. Bankole guided us along a narrow black-topped road that soon became a narrow dirt road. We saw a few cultivated fields, some scars left by past fires and logging, and a lot of land that seemed unused. The road all but vanished before we came to the end of it. Good for isolation. Bad for getting things in and out. Bad for traveling back and forth to get work. Bankole had said his brother-in-law had to spend a lot of time in various towns, away from his family. That was easier to understand now. There was no possibility here of coming home every day or two. So what did you have to do to save cash? Sleep in doorways or parks in town? Maybe it was worth the inconvenience to do just that, if you could keep your family together and safe, far from the desperate, the crazy, the vicious. Or, that's what I thought, until we reached the hillside, where Bankole's sister's house and outbuildings were supposed to be. There was no house. There were no buildings. There was almost nothing. A broad black smear on the hillside. a few charred planks sticking up from the rubble, some leaning against others, and a tall brick chimney standing black and solitary, like a tombstone in a picture of an old-style graveyard. A tombstone amid the bones and ashes. Chapter 25. Create no images of God. Accept the images that God has provided. They are everywhere, in everything. God is change. Seed to tree, tree to forest, rain to river, river to sea, grubs to bees, bees to swarm. From one, many. From many, one. Forever uniting, growing, dissolving, forever changing. The universe is God's self-portrait. Earthseed, the books of the living. Friday, October 1st, 2027. We've been arguing all week about whether or not we should stay here with the bones and ashes. We've found 5 skulls, 3 in what was left of the house and 2 outside. There were other scattered bones, but not one complete skeleton. Dogs have been at the bones, dogs and cannibals, perhaps. The fire happened long enough ago for weeds to begin to grow in the rubble. 2 months ago, 3? Some of the far-flung neighbors might know. Some of the far-flung neighbors might have set the fire. There was no way to be certain, but I assumed that the bones belonged to Bankole's sister and her family. I think Bankole assumed that too, but he couldn't bring himself to just bury the bones and write off his sister. The day after we got there, he and Harry hiked back to Glory, the nearest small town that we had passed through, to talk to the local cops. They were, or they professed to be, sheriff's deputies. I wonder what you have to do to become a cop. I wonder what a badge is, other than a license to steal. What did it used to be to make people Bankole's age want to trust it? I know what the old books say, but still, I wonder. The deputies all but ignored Bankole's story and his questions. They wrote nothing down, claimed to know nothing. They treated Bankole as though they doubted that he even had a sister, or that he was who he said he was. So many stolen IDs these days. They searched him and took the cash he was carrying. Fees for police services, they said. He had been careful to carry only what he thought would be enough to keep them sweet-tempered, but not enough to make them suspicious or more greedy than they already were. The rest, a sizable packet, he left with me. He trusted me enough to do that. His gun he left with Harry, who had gone shopping. Jail for Bankole could have meant being sold into a period of hard, unpaid labor, slavery. Perhaps if he had been younger, the deputies might have taken his money and arrested him anyway on some trumped-up charge. I had begged him not to go, not to trust any police or government official. It seemed to me such people were no better than gangs with their robbing and slaving. Bankole agreed with me, yet he insisted on going. "She was my little sister," he said. "I have to try, at least. To find out what happened to her. I need to know who did this. Most of all, I need to know whether any of her children could have survived. One or more of those 5 skulls could have belonged to the arsonists." He stared at the collection of bones. "I have to risk going to the sheriff's office," he continued. "But you don't. I don't want you with me. I don't want them getting any ideas about you. Maybe finding out by accident that you're a sharer. I don't want my sister's death to cost you your life or your freedom." We fought about it. I was afraid for him, he was afraid for me, and we were both angrier than we had ever been at each other. I was terrified that he would be killed or arrested, and we'd never find out what happened to him. No one should travel alone in this world. Look, he said at last, you can do some good here with the group. You'll have one of the four guns left here, and you know how to survive. You're needed here. If the cops decide they want me, you won't be able to do a thing. Worse, if they decide they want you, there'll be nothing I can do except take revenge and be killed for it. That slowed me down, the thought that I might cause his death instead of backing him up. I didn't quite believe it, but it slowed me down. Harry stepped in then and said he would go. He wanted to anyway. He could buy some things for the group, and he wanted to look for a job. He wanted to earn some money. I'll do what I can, he told me just before they left. He's not a bad old guy. I'll bring him back to you. They brought each other back. Bancole a few $1,000s poorer, and Harry still jobless, though they did bring back supplies and a few hand tools. Bancole knew no more than he had when he left about his sister and her family, but the cops had said they would come out to investigate the fire and the bones. We worried that sooner or later they might show up. We're still keeping a lookout for them, and we've hidden, buried, most of our valuables. We want to bury the bones, but we don't dare. It's bothering Bancole, bothering him a lot. I've suggested we hold a funeral and go ahead and bury the bones, to hell with the cops, but he says no. Best to give them as little provocation as possible. If they come, they would do enough harm with their stealing. Best not to give them reason to do more. There's a well with an old-fashioned hand pump under the rubble of an outbuilding. It still works. The solar-powered electric pump near the house does not. We couldn't stay here long without a dependable water source. With the well, though, it's hard to leave. Hard to walk away from possible sanctuary, in spite of arsonists and cops. Bancole owns this land, free and clear. There's a huge, half-ruined garden, plus citrus trees full of unripe fruit. We've already been pulling carrots and digging potatoes here. There are plenty of other fruit and nut trees, plus wild pines, redwoods, and Douglas firs. None of these last were very big. This area was logged sometime before Bancole bought it. Bancole says it was clear-cut, back in the 1980s or 1990s. But we can make use of the trees that have grown since then, and we can plant more. We can build a shelter. Put in a winter garden from the seed I've been carrying and collecting since I left home. Granted, a lot of it is old seed. I hadn't renewed it as often as I should have while I was at home. Strange that I hadn't. Things kept getting worse and worse at home, yet I had paid less and less attention to the pack that was supposed to save my life when the mob came. There was so much else to worry about, and I think I was into my own brand of denial, as bad in its way as Corey's or Joanne's mother's. But all that feels like ancient history. Now was what we had to worry about. What were we going to do now? I don't think we can make it here, Harry said earlier this evening as we sat around the campfire. There should be something cheerful about sitting around a campfire with friends and a full stomach. We even had meat tonight, fresh meat. Bancole took the rifle, and went off by himself for a while. When he came back, he brought three rabbits, which Zara and I skinned, cleaned, and roasted. We also roasted sweet potatoes that we had dug out of the garden. We should have been content. Yet all we were doing was rehashing what had become an old argument over the past few days. Perhaps it was the bones and ashes just over the rise that was bothering us. We had camped out of sight of the burned area in the hope of recovering a little peace of mind, but it hadn't helped. I was thinking that we should figure out a way to capture a few wild rabbits alive and breed them for a sure meat supply. Was that possible? Why not? If we stay here, and we should stay.
Nothing we find farther north will be any better or any safer than this, I said.
It will be hard to live here, but if we work together, and if we're careful, it should be possible. We can build a community here.
Oh, God, there she goes with her Earthseed shit again, Allie said.
But she smiled a little as she said it. That was good. She hadn't smiled much lately.
We can build a community here, I repeated.
It's dangerous, sure, but hell, it's dangerous everywhere. And the more people there are packed together in cities, the more danger there is. This is a ridiculous place to build a community. It's isolated, miles from everywhere, with no decent road leading here, but for us, for now, it's perfect.
Except that someone burned this place down last time, Grayson Mora said. Anything we build out here by itself is a target.
Anything we build anywhere is a target, Zara argued. But the people out here before... I'm sorry, Bencole, I gotta say this. They couldn't have kept a good watch. A man and a woman and three kids? They would have worked hard all day, then slept at night. It would have been too hard on two grown people to try to sit up and watch for half the night each.
They didn't keep a night watch, Bencole said. We'll have to keep one, though. And we could use a couple of dogs. If we could get them as puppies and train them to guard.
Give meat to dogs?
Mora demanded, outraged.
Not soon.
Bencole shrugged. Not until we have enough for ourselves, but if we can get dogs, they'll help us keep the rest of our goods.
I wouldn't give a dog nothing but a bullet or a rock, Mora said. I saw dogs eat a woman once.
There are no jobs in that town Bencole and I went to, Harry said. There was nothing. Not even work for room and board, I asked all over town. No one even knew of anything. I frowned. The towns around here are all close to the highway, I said.
They must get a lot of people passing through, looking for a place to settle, or maybe a place to rob, rape, kill. The locals wouldn't welcome new people. They wouldn't trust anyone they didn't know.
Harry looked from me to Bencole.
She's right, Bencole said.
My brother-in-law had a hard time before people began to get used to him. And he moved up here before things got so bad. He knew plumbing, carpentry, electrical work, and motor vehicle mechanics. Of course, it didn't help that he was black. Being white might help you win people over faster than he did. I think, though, that any serious money we make here will come from the land. Food is gold these days. We can grow food here. We have guns to protect ourselves so we can sell our crops in nearby towns or on the highway.
If we survive long enough to grow anything to sell, Mora muttered, if there's enough water, if the bugs don't eat our crops, if no one burns us out the way they did those people over the hill, if.
Allie sighed. Shit. It's if anywhere you go. This place isn't so bad.
She was sitting on her sleep sack, holding the sleeping Justin's head in her lap. As she spoke, she stroked the boy's hair. It occurred to me, not for the first time, that no matter how tough Allie tried to seem, that little boy was the key to her. Children were the key to most of the adults present.
There are no guarantees anywhere, I agreed. But if we're willing to work, our chances are good here. I've got some seed in my pack. We can buy more. What we have to do at this point is more like gardening than farming. Everything will have to be done by hand.
Composting, watering, weeding, picking worms or slugs or whatever off the crops and killing them one by one, if that's what it takes. As for water, if our well still has water in it now, in October, I don't think we have to worry about it going dry on us, not this year anyway. And if people threaten us, or our crop, we kill them. That's all, we kill them. Or they kill us. If we work together, we can defend ourselves, and we can protect the kids. A community's first responsibility is to protect its children. The ones we have now and the ones we will have. There was silence for a while. People digesting, perhaps measuring it against what they had to look forward to if they left this place and continued north. We have to decide, I said. We have building and planting to do here. We have to buy more food, more seed, and tools. It was time for directness. Allie, will you stay? She looked across the dead fire at me, stared hard at me as though she hoped to see something on my face that would give her an answer. What seed do you have? She asked. I drew a deep breath. Most of it is summer stuff. Corn, peppers, sunflowers, eggplant, melons, tomatoes, beans, squash. But I have some winter things. Peas, carrots, cabbage, broccoli, winter squash, onions, asparagus, herbs, several kinds of greens. We can buy more. And we've got the stuff left in this garden, plus what we can harvest from the local oak, pine, and citrus trees. I brought tree seeds, too. More oak, citrus, peach, pear, nectarine, almond, walnut, a few others. They won't do us any good for a few years, but they're a hell of an investment in the future. So is a kid, Allie said. I didn't think I would be dumb enough to say this, but yeah, I'll stay. I want to build something, too. I never had a chance to build anything before. Allie and Justin were a yes then. Harry? Zara? Of course we're staying, Zara said. Harry frowned. Wait a minute. We don't have to. I know, but we are. If we can make a community like Lauren says, and not have to hire out to strangers and trust them when they shouldn't be trusted, then we should do it. If you grew up where I did, you'd know we should. Harry, I said, I've known you all my life. You're the closest thing to a brother that I have left. You aren't really thinking about leaving, are you? It wasn't the world's best argument. He had been both cousin and lover to Joanne, and he'd let her go when he could have gone with her. I want something of my own, he said. Land, a home, maybe a store, or a small farm, something that's mine. This land is Bencole's. Yes, Bencole said. And you'll be getting the use of it rent-free, and all the water you need. What are those things going to cost you farther north, if you can get them at all farther north, if you can get yourself out of California? But there's no work here. There's nothing but work here, boy. Work and a lot of cheap land. How cheap do you think land will be up where you and all the rest of the world are heading? Harry thought about that, then spread his hands. What I'm worried about is spending all our money here, then discovering we can't make it here. I nodded. I've thought about that, too, and it bothers me. But it's a possibility anywhere, you know. You could settle in Oregon or Washington, not be able to get a job and run out of money. Or you could be forced to work under the conditions that Emery and Grayson found. After all, with rivers of people flowing north, looking for work, employers can take their pick and pay what they feel like paying. Emery put her arm around Tori, who sat drowsing next to her. You might be able to get a job as a driver, she said. They like white men to be drivers. If you can read and write, and if you do the work, you might get hired. I don't know how to drive, but I could learn, Harry said. You mean driving those big armored trucks, don't you? Emery looked confused. Trucks? No. I mean driving people, making them work, pushing them to work faster, making them do whatever the owner says. Harry's expression had dissolved from hopeful to horrified to outraged. Jesus God, do you think I'd do that? How could you think I'd do anything like that? Emery shrugged. It startled me that she could be indifferent about such a thing, but she seemed to be. Some people think it's a good job, she said. Last driver we had, he used to do something with computers, I don't know what. His company went out of business, and he got a job driving us. I think he liked it. Em, Harry said. He pitched his voice low and waited until she looked at him. Are you telling me you believe I'd like a job pushing slaves around and taking away their children? She stared back, searching his face. I hope not, she said, and then, sometimes jobs like that are the only jobs. Slave and slave driver. I heard that just on this side of the Canada border, there are a lot of factories with jobs like that. I frowned. Factories that use slave labor? Yeah. Workers make things for companies in Canada or Asia. They don't get paid much, so they get into debt. They get hurt or sick, too. Their drinking water is not clean, and the factories are dangerous, full of poisons and machines that crush or cut you. But people think they can make some cash and then quit. I worked with some women who had gone up there, taken a look, and come back. And you were going up there? Harry demanded. Not to work in those places. The women warned me. I've heard of places like that, Bencole said. They were supposed to provide jobs for that northward flowing river of people. President Donner's all for them. The workers are more throwaways than slaves. They breathe toxic fumes or drink contaminated water or get caught in unshielded machinery. It doesn't matter. They're easy to replace. Thousands of jobless for every job. Border works, Mora said. Not all of them are that bad. I heard some pay cash wages, not company scrip. Is that where you want to go? I asked. Or do you want to stay here? He looked down at Doe, who was still nibbling at a piece of sweet potato. I want to stay here, he said, surprising me. I'm not sure you have a hope in hell of building anything here, but you're just crazy enough to make it work. And if it didn't work, he'd be no worse off than he was when he escaped slavery. He could rob someone and continue his journey north, or maybe not. I'd been thinking about Mora. He did a lot to keep people away from him, keep them from knowing too much about him, keep them from seeing what he was feeling or that he was feeling anything. A male sharer, desperate to hide his terrible vulnerability. Sharing would be harder on a man. What would my brothers have been like as sharers? Odd that I hadn't thought of that before. I'm glad you're staying, I said. We need you. I looked at Travis and Natividad. We need you guys, too. You're staying, aren't you? You know we are, Travis said, although I think I agree more than I want to with Mora. I'm not sure we have a prayer of succeeding here. We'll have whatever we can shape, I said. And I turned to face Harry. He and Zara had been whispering together. Now he looked at me. Moira's right, he said. You're nuts. I sighed. But this is a crazy time, he continued. Maybe you're what the time needs, or what we need. I'll stay. I may be sorry for it, but I'll stay. Now the decision is acknowledged, and we can stop arguing about it. Tomorrow, we'll begin to prepare a winter garden. Next week, several of us will go into town to buy tools, more seed, supplies. Also, it's time we began to build a shelter. There are trees enough in the area, and we could dig into the ground and into the hills. Mora says he's built slave cabins before, says he's eager to build something better, something fit for human beings. Besides, this far north and this near the coast, we might get some rain. Sunday, October 10th, 2027. Today, we had a funeral for Bankole's dead, the five people who died in the fire. The cops never came. At last, Bankole has decided that they aren't going to come, and that it's time his sister and her family had a decent burial. We collected all the bones that we could find, and yesterday, Natividad wrapped them in a shawl that she had knitted years ago. It was the most beautiful thing she owned. A thing like that should serve the living, Bankole said when she offered it. You are the living, Natividad said. I like you. I wish I could have met your sister. He looked at her for a while. Then he took the shawl and hugged her. Then, beginning to cry, he went off by himself into the trees out of our sight. I let him alone for an hour or so, then went after him. I found him, sitting on a fallen log, wiping his face. I sat with him for some time, saying nothing. After a while, he got up, waited for me to stand, then headed back toward our camp. I would like to give them a grove of oak trees, I said. Trees are better than stone. Life commemorating life. He glanced back at me. All right. Bankole? He stopped, looked at me with an expression I couldn't read. None of us knew her, I said. I wish we had. I wish I had, no matter how much I would have surprised her. He managed a smile. She would have looked at you, then looked at me, then right in front of you, I think she would have said, well, there's no fool like an old fool. Once she got that out of her system, I think she would have gotten to like you. Do you think she could stand or forgive company now? What? I drew a deep breath and wondered about what I meant to say. It could go wrong. He could misunderstand. It still needed to be said. We'll bury your dead tomorrow. I think you're right to want to do it. And I think we should bury our dead as well. Most of us have had to walk away or run away from our unburned, unburied dead. Tomorrow, we should remember them all and lay them to rest if we can. Your family? I nodded. Mine? Zara's, Harry's, Allie's, both her son and her sister, maybe Emery's sons, maybe others that I don't know about. Mora doesn't talk about himself much, but he must have losses. Doe's mother, perhaps. How do you want to do it? He asked. Each of us will have to bury our own dead. We knew them. We can find the words. Words from the Bible, perhaps. Any words. Memories, quotations, thoughts, songs. My father had a funeral, even though we never found his body. But my three youngest brothers and my stepmother had nothing. Zara saw them die, or I wouldn't have any idea what happened to them. I thought for a moment. I have acorns enough for each of us to plant live oak trees to our dead. Enough to plant one for Justin's mother, too. I'm thinking about a very simple ceremony, but everyone should have a chance to speak. Even the two little girls. He nodded. I don't have any objection. It isn't a bad idea. And a few steps later, there's been so much dying. There's so much more to come. Not for us, I hope. He said nothing for a while. Then he stopped and put his hand on my shoulder to stop me. At first, he only stood looking at me, almost studying my face. You're so young, he said. It seems almost criminal that you should be so young in these terrible times. I wish you could have known this country when it was still salvageable. It might survive, I said, changed, but still itself. No. He drew me to his side and put one arm around me. Human beings will survive, of course. Some other countries will survive. Maybe they'll absorb what's left of us. Or maybe we'll just break up into a lot of little states quarreling and fighting with each other over whatever crumbs are left. That's almost happened now, with states shutting themselves off from one another, treating state lines as national borders. As bright as you are, I don't think you understand. I don't think you understand what we've lost. Perhaps it's a blessing. God is change, I said. Olamina, that doesn't mean anything. It means everything. Everything. He sighed. You know, as bad as things are, we haven't even hit bottom yet. Starvation, disease, drug damage, and mob rule have only begun. Federal, state, and local governments still exist, in name at least, and sometimes they manage to do something more than collect taxes and send in the military. And the money is still good. That amazes me. However much more you need of it to buy anything these days, it is still accepted. That may be a hopeful sign, or perhaps it's only more evidence of what I just said. We haven't hit bottom yet. Well, the group of us here doesn't have to sink any lower, I said. He shook his shaggy head, his hair, beard, and serious expression, making him look more than a little like an old picture I used to have of Frederick Douglass. I wish I believed that, he said. Perhaps it was his grief talking. I don't think we have a hope in hell of succeeding here. I slipped my arm around him. Let's go back, I said. We've got work to do. So today, we remembered the friends and the family members we've lost. We spoke our individual memories and quoted Bible passages, earthseed verses, and bits of songs and poems that were favorites of the living or the dead. Then we buried our dead, and we planted oak trees. Afterward, we sat together and talked and ate a meal and decided to call this place Acorn. A sower went out to sow his seed, and as he sowed, some fell by the wayside, and it was trodden down, and the fowls of the air devoured it. And some fell upon a rock, and as soon as it was sprung up, it withered away because it lacked moisture. And some fell among thorns, and the thorns sprang up with it and choked it. And others fell on good ground, and sprang up, and bore fruit an hundredfold. The Bible, Authorized King James Version, St. Luke, chapter 8, verses 5 through 8.
The End. You've been listening to Parable of the Sower by Octavia E. Butler, narrated by Lynn Thigpen. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.